Mania Crawl is the annual bar crawl that takes place WrestleMania weekend, and this year it comes to Dallas. All the money raised goes towards Connor's cure and the Children's Hospital. They'll be selling Mania Crawl t-shirts on teespring.com through February 28th. So only one more week. Teespring kicks back about $6 per shirt, which will also be donated towards Connor's cure and the Children's Hospital. They've also teamed up with Uber to be the official designated driver of Mania Crawl 2016. Just use the code MANIACRAWL16 for your first ride free up to $20. Every ride taken with their code, Uber will donate $5 towards Connor's cure. The first 100 people in attendance will get a free Mania Crawl koozie. For more information, check them out on Twitter and Instagram at Mania Crawl or visit maniacrawl.com.
It's business time, baby.
The Solid Monster sounds off.
My client, Brock Lesnar, conquered the streak.
This doesn't make any sense.
Your title belt is made of leather. You're not a real vegan.
He's fat. You haven't been beat up properly. Woo!
Welcome to episode 426 of the Solid Monster Sounds Off here for Fastlane Sunday, February 21st, 2016. I am the Solid Monster. I'm still buzzing from last week's Walking Dead. Can't believe how many people have written that show off. My own brother stopped watching it two seasons ago. It's his loss. Last week's episode, not going to give away any spoilers, although apparently it jives with the comics. I never read the comics. I stay away from the comics. People were very happy it stayed true to the comics. It had to be one of the best episodes of the entire series. And if you're the kind of person who's into the action and the gore and the violence, then it probably was the best episode of the series. It's a hell of a mid-season opener. And Better Call Saul is back, too. I don't know how many of you are familiar with the show, if you were a Breaking Bad fan. This was kind of a spin-off, prequel-type show to Breaking Bad. This is season two. It's actually a really good show. I would recommend you check it out. One of the things I loved about the episode last week, again, this is the second season. This was episode, this was the first episode. One of the things I loved about it was they had a little Breaking Bad cameo. If you are a Breaking Bad fan, I don't know how many of you remember the first season. There was a scene, the guy whose car Walt blows up at the gas station. I think it was the first season. Maybe it was the second one. Anyway, that guy makes a cameo here on Better Call Saul. I love the little attention to detail. I wish we would get that on Raw. Wouldn't that be nice? I wanted to thank everybody who sent in feedback to me that I asked for last week, whether or not you were able to download the show or stream the show without problems. Unfortunately, some people still did have problems, but the vast majority of you said it was great. And some of the people that had that issue in iTunes where it would say temporarily unavailable. Again, all of this was because of the massive traffic. That's what Podbean said. And there was some, it was a traffic issue more than anything else. It's been worked out with Podbean. It's not perfect. Some people apparently are still having some problems. And that, you know, that sucks. And I want to try to fix that. But I would say at least 90% of you now are back on track and things should be working fine. And again, if you're trying to listen to the show one way and it's not working, there's a whole bunch, there's at least half a dozen, if not a dozen, different ways to listen to this show. You can get the show on iTunes, you can get the show on Stitcher. I know Stitcher was down, you know, throughout, their whole system was taken down. I think now everything is back to normal. So you can listen that way. We have a free app in the Google Play Store. You don't have to pay for it. You can download it, listen to that, you know, the show that way if you have an Android device. We're on player.fm, Audio Boom. Tune in radio. There's so many different ways to get the show. So everybody should be good to go. Thank you for sending in your feedback to me on that. I appreciate that. Want to show some love to Audible. Audible's been good to the Sound Off this year. You can check out the service free for the next 30 days. No cost to you. No strings attached. Just use our URL, audibletrial.com/solemonster. Punch that in. Go through the sign-up process. When you do so, you get to pick one free audiobook, and in case you didn't know, there's a ton of wrestling books up there. So if you want to read Daniel Bryan's book, if you want, especially now in light of his career being over, it might be interesting to go and listen to his perspective. One of the interesting things about Bryan's book, and I still haven't gotten to it, but I've heard about it, is the way it ends. And one of the things that he says at the very end of the book, when you know he's talking about whether or not looking back on his whole career and the sacrifices he had to make, was it worth it? And he gives a very surprising answer. You can get Brian's book. You can get Brock Lesnar's book, Chris Jericho, Shawn Michaels, Hulk Hogan, bunch of other wrestling books. And even if you cancel during the trial, you don't like Audible or it's not your thing, that's cool. You don't get billed, you get to keep the book. So audibletrial.com/Solomonster, use our link, get yourself a free audiobook download. Of course, we have our store on ProWrestlingTees.com, the Solomonster Sounds Off store. You can go directly to it, ProWrestlingTees.com/Solomonster Sounds Off, over 20 shirts to choose from. And if you want to make a PayPal donation, you are free to do so on thesolomonster.com. $10 or more will get you a wrestling nickname. I want to say thank you this week to John Loose Cannon Lopez, Out of Control Cody Thomas, Deadpool James Herrera, James Hollywood Henderson, Jet Setter John Peterson, The Dark Serpent Derek Gibbs, Doomsday Donde Page, End of Days Eric Owen, Ryan the Dagger McTaggart, Alvin Chainsaw Siegerts, Judge and Jury Justin Girardi, Crotch Chop, Cody White, hell of a name there. The Newport Nightmare, Adam Grendel. The Human Torch, Troy Smith. Luke Wargames Willoughby. Damn Straight, Michael Dorsey. The Saudi Prince, Abdulaziz Gambi. Masked Mayhem, Javier Mitchell. First Class LT Gilberry. Jamie the Emerald Hammer Emerson. Low Blow, Lee Jansen. The Chosen Son, Andre Smith. Quick Draw, Benjamin Quesnel. Jamie the Radical Rutherford, Matthew the Sentinel Setzer, and Christopher Pimp Daddy Purington, who turns 26 today, so happy birthday, Chris, and his brother, Robert the Iceman Purington. Thank you very much for your donations here to the podcast. Help keep this machine going here. Bret Hart. Update on Bret Hart. He had successful surgery to remove his entire prostate. They found that his cancer was pretty much contained, or they think it was contained. I mean, take it from me, you never know with these things. But it's a positive report. Looks like it was contained to the prostate, so they just got rid of the whole thing, and he's on the mend. He should have a full recovery. He shouldn't need any chemo or radiation, which is awesome. If you can always avoid that, that's always a good thing. So very, very happy to hear that, and hopefully Brett continues to get well, and we'll see him back on TV at some point. There were a lot of different news stories, rumors going around this week. We are going to do fast lane predictions here in a couple of minutes, but I want to just kind of tackle some of these other stories first, and then we can move on. One of the bigger stories, Ryan Satin over at Pro Wrestling Sheet broke earlier in the week that Wade Barrett leaving WWE when his contract expires in June. A few days went by before Barrett said anything, and when he did, he didn't really have much to say. I mean, he's not going to come out and admit it, I guess, but he also didn't deny it. He said, I'll comment further at a more appropriate time, but for now, I am 100% focused on doing my job for WWE. See you at Fastlane on Sunday. So I think that says it all right there. I was sad to hear that. I mean, it's not as though Barrett was really one of the key players in WWE right now. It's not like, oh my God, the machine is going to crumble without him or anything, but, you know, if you take a look at Barrett's career, he's been around for a long time. They signed him in 2007. So he has spent almost a decade of his life in some form or fashion with this company. They promoted him to the main roster in 2010. I'm sure you all remember it. It was the first season of NXT, which at the time was a very different show than what NXT is now. It was the first season of NXT on Sci-Fi Network, where they paired off the newer guys, the rookies, I guess, if you will, from FCW, I think it still might have been at the time, paired them off with a pro. And Barrett's pro was, or his mentor, was Chris Jericho. And they would judge them each week in different matches and competitions. And Wade Barrett won that first season of NXT. And even then, you know, he was a lot younger, a lot less experienced. But even then, you know, he was a good talker. And that, again, goes all the way back to 2010. You know, he was good wrestler, good talker. That same year, they did the Nexus Invasion, which I think to this day is still one of the hottest angles that company's ever done. I still remember the excitement. You know, it's weird. I still remember that night vividly, like it happened a year or two ago. I remember that night. This was before Raw was 3 hours permanently. Okay, this was the pre-3-hour Raw era. But every now and then they would do those 3-hour Raws. It would be a big special. They'd have a gimmick like King of the Ring or something. And it was in June, and I don't remember if there was a gimmick or what the purpose was, but that was a 3-hour Raw. And I missed a good part of the show because I was out. I think I was actually at the Empire State Building. I was at the observatory up there for some reason. And I remember I'm on the bus, I'm coming home, and I'm looking at tweets, and people are just ripping that show to shreds. It was such a shit show. And I was laughing. I was like, well, I guess I'm not missing much. And then I get home, and they were doing, actually, it was more like that Taboo Tuesday voting. I think they did voting on who do you want to wrestle John Cena in the main event, and it was either Rey Mysterio, CM Punk, who at the time was wearing a mask, or somebody else, I forget who. And Punk won. Maybe surprisingly, since he was a heel. So they did Punk and Cena in the main event, and that's when they had all the Nexus guys from Season 1, from Barrett to Bryan to Michael Tarver and Heath Slater and Skip Sheffield and whoever else was out there, Justin Gabriel. You know, they came out of the crowd, they attacked Cena, they attacked Punk, and it was just the way it was done. They went after the announcers, they beat them up, they overturned the announce desk. They ripped up the mat so you could see the wood, the plywood underneath the ring. I mean, this was something we had never seen before, and it was just mass chaos. It was very unlike anything you would normally see on Raw back, you know, during that period. And people were so excited. They were, oh my God, this is like the second coming of the New World Order. It's like a new NWO. This is so cool, only it's with younger guys. Don't fuck this up. Which I'll get to that in a second. But it was a great angle, and Barrett was kind of the ringleader of all that. And you had high hopes for these guys, and for a while they were really pushing them like something special. Ricky Steamboat, they were doing stuff with the Legends where they would beat up the Legends. Unfortunately, they beat up Ricky Steamboat a little too much. He ended up having an aneurysm and almost died. But they went on to SummerSlam. They had a big 10-man tag at SummerSlam that year. It was Team Cena against Team Nexus. Of course, we all know what happened to Daniel Bryan that night during the whole angle. He got fired. He was choking Justin Roberts with his tie. They brought him back 2 months later. But that 10-man tag at SummerSlam, they really had a chance to put these guys over the top. You know, up to that point, they kept them strong. People were still into it. They were excited. And then they hit the brick wall that is John Cena, as so many other guys have hit. And I'm not someone who normally comes on here and John Cena's burying everybody. But the fact is, when you really look at his record, when he goes up, you know, they take some of these guys, whether it's, you know, Wyatt or Rusev or whoever it may be. And Rusev was clearly being groomed. I said, you know, 6 months earlier, I said, Rusev is undefeated. He's the U.S. champion. He's being kept strong. The only reason this guy is being kept strong is to lose to Cena at WrestleMania. And that's what happened. You know, that was his role. He had to lose at some point, and he did. And then he lost again, and he lost again. Bray Wyatt, I still to this day do not understand what the hell they were thinking. There was no reason for John Cena to win that match at WrestleMania 30, but he did. I guess they just wanted to keep the feud going, but, you know, Bray Wyatt, I would argue, was never the same after that. And you could argue who was hurt more by that, Rusev or Wyatt. I would say Wyatt, just because Wyatt, I think, had, and still does have potential to be a top guy, although I see it more as a babyface, not a heel. But the Nexus ran into Cena, and they lost. And the Nexus never recovered, and I would say Wade Barrett never recovered after that. You know, the guy, he was plagued by injuries, too. Can't ignore that. First injury, though, total freak accident. It was a battle royal on Raw. Barrett was outside the ring. I think he had been dumped out. Big Show was in there with Dolph Ziggler. He picks up Ziggler, throws Ziggler out of the ring at Barrett. I think it was Barrett and R-Truth are standing outside the ring. He chucks Ziggler out of the ring and right into Barrett, and Barrett lands, and he's just pounding the floor, and he's cursing up a storm. He's so pissed off because he dislocated his elbow, and it was a pretty bad dislocation. They thought at first he would only be out for a few weeks. He ended up being out for like 4 months or 6 months or something like that, and the timing just couldn't be shittier for him, because the rumor at that time was that Barrett was in line to win Money in the Bank that year. He was going to win the briefcase, and, you know, history was on the side of those who won the briefcases, because in most cases, that person went on to win the championship. And so Barrett now is hurt. He's out for all those months. You look at the next injury, Jack Swagger threw him into the ringside barricade. He suffered a separated shoulder. Again, you know, kind of a freak thing. You know, was it Swagger's fault? You know, is it just a case where Barrett is injury prone? I don't know, but you look at these injuries, and they seem more like fluky freak things than anything else. Now he's got the nerve damage in his neck. That's what's kept him out for the last few months. It's hard for WWE to get behind a guy if he keeps getting hurt. I get that. And so, you know, Barrett is not completely blameless in that. But, you know, I'm sorry. Randy Orton. Randy Orton is a guy who's had plenty of injuries. The guy's had two broken collarbones. Now he's got an injured shoulder. Just had major surgery. And that never stopped WWE from getting behind the guy when the guy healed up and came back. Hey, let's put him right back in the main event. That never stopped them from doing that. And Barrett's a guy who had, I think, you know, every bit as much potential. He's got the size. He's not a small guy. He's a big guy. He's a legitimate tough guy. Bare-knuckle fighter. He's a great promo. He's got personality. You know, I mean, look, anybody who does bare-knuckle fighting is tough enough for me. And there's still something to be said, I think, for having someone who does have a legit background like that. Hey, look, if I was in a bare-knuckle fight, I'd fucking point at the sky and hope the other guy turns around so I can grab a 2x4 and smash it over the back of his head, and then I'd run the other way. I'm mad enough to admit that. But, I mean, from day one, Barrett had the size, he had the promo ability. There was a time where I thought, and I talked about it here on the podcast, that I thought Sheamus and Barrett, that was going to be a WrestleMania main event one day for the World Championship. But this was back when the titles were split. So maybe it would have been for the World Heavyweight title, not the WWE title. But I thought those two guys, those two big, you know, the big European guys are going to go in there and beat the crap out of each other. I thought that could be a world title match one day at WrestleMania. And, you know, never worked out that way. And I just go back to that Nexus invasion. You know, when they had Cena tap Barrett out at SummerSlam to end that match, that was it. That was it. You know, they kept the storyline going. Barrett got a couple of pay-per-view main events. They even gave him a win over Cena at whatever pay-per-view that was in October. And he had a championship match at Survivor Series, I think, with Randy Orton. But it didn't matter. You know, the die was already cast at that point. Now, maybe if he didn't get hurt in 2012, when he dislocated the elbow and he would have won Money in the Bank, maybe things would have turned out differently. But, you know, they had their chance with the guy, and they squandered it. I think back to Chris Jericho's book. You know, he talks about him and Edge having a little bit of a beef with Cena over what happened at SummerSlam. Because, you know, Jericho and Edge could see. They could see what's going on here. And Cena, no. You know, they had Barrett give Cena a DDT on the exposed concrete outside the ring. And Cena's great idea was, I'm going to get right back up from it. You know, like 2 minutes later, and I'm going to tap the guy out in the STF. And that's what he did. And it was only after that was already done, Cena kind of realized, hey, maybe that wasn't the best idea. And Cena, you know, he was man enough to recognize, hey, I fucked up, I made a mistake. He apologized for it, he admitted it was a shitty idea. But again, at that point, it was too late. I mean, these guys had some real momentum, and, you know, after that, they just became another group of guys. You know, that runs into Cena and gets vanquished. I mean, the guy gives you a fucking DDT on the concrete floor, and 2 minutes later, you know, you're tapping out like a madman, and people are supposed to take these guys seriously? So, I mean, the injuries didn't help. But to me, I look at, you know, because that's all people have been talking about when I've seen, like, articles and stuff about this. Well, you know, Barrett was injury prone, and it's a shame, and so I went back and I looked, and I'm like, okay, he had the elbow thing, which was not his fault. He had the thing where he got thrown into the barricade, and now whatever's going on with him now. I don't remember there being any other significant injuries with him. I look at him and I say, I don't know. I mean, he wasn't any more or less injured than a lot of the guys who they did get behind. And I think Barrett at one time was a guy worth getting behind. And it's a shame he fizzled out the way that he did. Now, I don't know if he wants to keep wrestling or not. Maybe he's going to get out of wrestling completely. I could see him doing movies. But if he does want to continue to wrestle, I think him and Drew Galloway could probably have some fun matches together. I know they came up together on the indies, you know, them and Sheamus. They all kind of came up at the same time together. And if you look at those UK promotions right now, they're on fire. You know, UK wrestling over there, that's on fire right now. I think Barrett could be a big player if he wanted to be. Another big piece of news with WWE this week, Triple H made the announcement that they are debuting a new global cruiserweight series. It's going to premiere on Wednesday, July 13th. It's going to air after NXT on Wednesday nights at 9 o'clock Eastern. I'm just going to read here from the description. For the first time ever, WWE invites cruiserweights from all over the world to compete in the inaugural Global Cruiserweight Series. 32 of the greatest in-ring competitors under 205 pounds will descend upon Full Sail University in Orlando and collide for 10 weeks to earn the right to call themselves the best cruiserweight in the world. Pretty cool. We have examples of this already. Ring of Honor has their Young Prospect Tournament. I didn't get to watch Ring of Honor this week, but I think last week when I was reviewing the show, they were actually, one of the matches I talked about was a match from their Young Prospect Tournament. So they've been doing that for a while. New Japan has their Super Juniors Tournament every year. In another interview that he did, I want to read this quote from Triple H, because this adds a little more to this. He said, obviously, if anyone is under contract with, say, New Japan Pro Wrestling, I don't think they're going to have the opportunity to perform in this type of tournament. Though anybody that has the opportunity, freedom, and availability to do something like this with us, we are looking at working with them. I'm open to working with other groups that are out there, like Progress, Evolve, Rev Pro, and places like that. They have a lot of talent they work with. But those talents have that ability to do other things. It's an opportunity to be on a platform, to be seen by millions around the world, and become much bigger stars in their own right. So that's pretty cool, you know, to have Triple H openly acknowledging, well, you know, okay, New Japan, and obviously TNA and ROH, those guys are under contract, we're not going to be able to use them, but, you know, we are aware of all these other promotions. I mean, I just mentioned, right, the UK is a hotbed for wrestling right now. You got Rev Pro and Progress and ICW as well as another one I keep hearing things about. So he's acknowledging that we want to be able to take guys from those promotions who aren't locked up under contract. We want them. And not necessarily that we want to steal them all away. We want to give them a platform to make their name even bigger and to be part of this tournament and for our audience to be exposed to these guys for the first time. Now, the first name that comes to mind when I heard about this, the first name that popped in my head, who I'd love to see part of this, is Ricochet. He's tied up with Lucha Underground, so that's not going to happen. And WWE, you know, they passed on him years ago, so that's their loss. I think he'll end up there one day. I think once his Lucha Underground contract is over, you know, however many more years that is, I could see Ricochet coming over. But that's their loss. I have a lot of people telling me I need to watch more of Zack Sabre Jr. I think he just signed a deal with New Japan, so I would assume that takes him out of the running for this as well. Here's what I think is going to end up happening here. I think we end up seeing a bunch of NXT guys that they have under contract. We haven't really seen much of them or seen any of them in some cases. Some of them still haven't debuted on TV. I think Rich Swann has made a couple of appearances. He was at the tapings they did over Rumble weekend. I'm sure we'll see him in there, if I had to take a guess. Biff Busick is another one. La Sombra, they signed him a few months ago. He's not going by that name in WWE. I forget what name he's been using at the live events. They could use this to kind of debut him if they wanted to, get him in there. Johnny Gargano is another one, maybe a few other Evolve guys. They're obviously working with Evolve. It would stand to reason we're going to see some of those guys in this thing. They have Tommaso Ciampa, but I don't know if he's under 205. Maybe somebody could check on that. If he is, he could be part of this too, but I'm pretty sure he's bigger than that. Gargano is a smaller guy. I'm almost positive he's under 205. And then we'll end up with a good number of guys that we've never heard of before. They'll bring some of those guys in as well. And like I said, for these guys, it's a chance to get their names out there. Maybe we haven't heard of them yet. You know, you got a few diamonds in the rough over there in the UK and in Europe. You know, bring them in. Let us see what they're all about. And then also, you know, WWE, even though they're not going to sign all of these guys, you know, all right, you know, Triple H ain't doing this just for the hell of it. You know they're going to want to sign a bunch of them because they're not building 32 people up on their own network for 10 weeks just to let them all go back to where they came from. I use Tough Enough as an example, right? How many people were on Tough Enough? I think it was 10, right? It was about 10 people, give or take, on Tough Enough. And, you know, Big Josh won and Sarah Lee won, so they got contracts. And it's like, look, they spent, what, 10 weeks, 13 weeks, whatever it was, on USA Network, no less, with this show, giving these people airtime and kind of, you know, letting us know more about them and getting us familiar with them, and they're not just going to let all of them go. And so what ended up happening? Yeah, they got Josh and Sarah Lee, but they gave Amanda a contract. They gave fucking ZZ a contract. Patrick is now wrestling for them. I think there's a couple of others, too. almost the entire cast ended up being signed. So, you know, this is not going to be any different. They're going to want to sign a bunch of these guys. You know, it's as much a talent search for them as anything else. I like that Triple H is at least keeping more of an open mind with these things than Vince McMahon probably would. I mean, that's the difference I see between the two of them so far, and just in terms of how they operate. One of them is just stuck in his ways, stuck in the past. The other one is at least open to new ideas. He wants to ingratiate himself with the Full Sail crowd, we'll call them. I'll use that as a euphemism for smart mark, since I hate that term. But that's what he's doing here, and it's working. You know, I see messages online, oh, thank you, Based H. I never see thank you, Based Vince. And where did this Based nonsense start anyway? What the fuck does that even mean? Maybe somebody could clue me in. But I mean, as far as the idea for the Cruiserweight Tournament, I love it. I think it's a great idea. I'm not in love with the idea maybe at some point of them bringing back the Cruiserweight title to TV, you know, to Raw or SmackDown, if that were to eventually happen, simply because they have not demonstrated an ability to run a Cruiserweight division and know what the fuck they're doing. They did have a light heavyweight division many, many years ago, not long after the invasion. And they had guys like X-Pac and Billy Kidman and Tajiri. It was kind of an offshoot of what WCW was doing. And then what happened? As with most things, they got bored and it went away. So I don't trust them. You know, on NXT, I might. If they wanted to try something like that on NXT, I would have a lot more faith in Triple H and whoever they have writing the show over there. But not the main roster. So I actually am not in favor of bringing the Cruiserweight stuff back to Raw and SmackDown until they can, you know, prove to me, as a fan, that they know how to use those guys, because I don't believe they do. But in terms of this idea, as like a gimmick on the network, cool. Cool, I want to see them doing more stuff like this. There's a lot of cool stuff on the network right now. You know, that New Edge and Christian show is debuting tonight after the pay-per-view. I'm going to talk about the Stone Cold podcast with Big Show a little bit later, which I thought was the best one yet. I thought that was just tremendous stuff. So they're cranking out a lot of good things right now with the network. They got another one of those live specials coming up next month in Toronto. I'd like to see them, you know, eventually take a chance and actually take a big pay-per-view like a Royal Rumble or a SummerSlam and bring it over to the UK, for example. You got your own network now. You don't have to worry about time zone differences and stuff. You know, give them a big event. I don't see them giving them WrestleMania. You know, plus you have to bid on WrestleMania, but you got your own network, you can play around with it, you can have a big show in the UK or in Australia, like a big pay-per-view. I want to see them try that. I'd love to see them also start adding things like old Coliseum home videos to the network and put their frickin' DVD library on there, since DVD is a dying technology anyway. So there's a lot of things they could still be doing with the network, but I think some of the stuff that they're already doing is actually pretty cool. All right, let's talk about Fastlane now. That is coming up tonight. Fastlane from Cleveland, Ohio. And we'll start with the main event. We'll work backwards. Roman Reigns, Dean Ambrose, and Brock Lesnar. Winner challenges Triple H for the championship at WrestleMania 32. I want Dean Ambrose to win. I know better than to think he will. I think he was put in this match specifically to eat the pin so that Brock doesn't have to. And Roman can finally get his big moment of glory that he was deprived of last year because of us shitty fans. I thought it was smart of them to take the Intercontinental title off Ambrose on Monday night because it plants the seeds of doubt in people's minds who thought for sure, oh, well, Roman's a lock to win. There's no other outcome. And I think most people probably still feel that way. But now, you know, Dean is free from the shackles of that title. And maybe, just maybe, he'll eke out a win. There's at least a chance. But I still don't think it's happening. And I don't think they would do back-to-back triple threat matches with, you know, they got Reigns, Ambrose, and Lesnar, and then turn around to WrestleMania and do Reigns, Ambrose, and Triple H. So I don't think they would do that. So I'm sticking with the obvious choice. I'm going to stick with my original pick. I was kind of wavering a little bit, but I'm going to stick with this. I think Brock's about to win. Lights go out, the Wyatts take him out of the match. That paves the way for Roman to pin Dean again, just like he did at Survivor Series. I might be more open to the possibility that Ambrose might have a chance here if it wasn't for The Rock. I keep thinking about The Rock. you know, we still don't know what The Rock is doing at WrestleMania, but he was building that thing up on social media when they first announced it, like, oh, this is going to be something you've never seen before. This is going to be huge. He's like, Trump, this is going to be huge. This is going to be monumental. And it doesn't look like he's wrestling. So if he's not wrestling a match, then what the hell is this guy going to be doing at the pay-per-view? To me, you know, it almost surely means he's going to play some kind of role in Roman's match, and it only makes sense if it's Reigns against Triple H. If you take Reigns and put him in some undercard match, what the hell does The Rock need to be involved for? You know, they tried to use The Rock to endorse Reigns last year. It backfired on them. Ambrose is the one of the two right now, I think, that most people would like to see. You know, and I think they should have learned something from those last few minutes of the Royal Rumble match when it came down to Triple H and it came down to Dean. Roman got dumped out. People cheered. They were excited when they saw the final two. They were going crazy for those 2 or 3 minutes. I think they should have learned something from that. But I doubt they did. So I think Reigns goes on to WrestleMania. And speaking of Brock, I should bring this up now. He was on SportsCenter on Tuesday night. They tape these interviews earlier in the day at the SmackDown tapings, whenever they do these ESPN things, and Brock was on SmackDown this week. In fact, I think this might have been his first SmackDown appearance since 2004. So he was on SportsCenter being interviewed by Jonathan Coachman. He was asked about the Daniel Bryan retirement. Brock was praising Bryan for knowing when to step away, and then he admitted that he himself cannot even count on two hands how many concussions he's had. That he didn't even know about. So we're not even talking about the ones he does know about. Just the concussions he's almost sure he's had that he does not know about. He can't even count them on two hands. This is where things get real dicey now. Because anytime one of these guys publicly admits something like that, it opens WWE up to criticism if they don't do anything about it. It's like, how do you justify not clearing Daniel Bryan because of his history of concussions, when you've got this guy who got punched in the face for real by guys in UFC, who's admitting on national TV that he's had so many concussions he's lost count? You know, they're not going to suspend Brock or anything like that, but it opens them up to questions about why. Why not? Why give preferential treatment to some but not others? It's like I said last week, it's not an easy question. I'm not even sure what I would do if I were in their shoes. I'm glad I'm not in their shoes. I'd probably lose half my roster if I took everybody out of the ring who's ever had more than 3 concussions in their life. But I'm sure WWE could not have been very happy with Brock going out there and saying that a week after one of their guys had to retire because of concussions. We have Chris Jericho and AJ Styles, part 3. AJ's got to win this match. I still smell a Jericho heel turn coming. I think they got to keep it going to WrestleMania somehow. But AJ's my pick. I mean, he's got to win this match. Kevin Owens against Dolph Ziggler, Intercontinental Championship. Owens is the new champion. I'm going to go with Kevin Owens. They didn't put the belt back on him just to take it away. Owens retains. Plus, I think the last 2 matches against Ziggler, he's lost. So he's due for a win. Charlotte and Brie Bella for the Divas Championship. I know she's retiring very soon. I don't think she's retiring here. I think it's the summer, I think she said. She was on Good Morning America. She said something about the summer. So I don't think this is her last match, but she's nearing the end. And so you might say, well, maybe they'll give her a token title run. You know, her career's coming to an end. It'll be a nice moment. Fuck that. I don't want any nice moments here. I want them to do the right thing, which is keep the belt on Charlotte. There's no point in beating Charlotte before WrestleMania. Charlotte retains. Big Show, Kane, and Ryback versus the Wyatt family. Or as I like to call it, a refrigerator break. Wyatt family's got to win, especially if they're going to do anything with the Wyatts and Brock. You've got to keep them... They're doing something for sure, because they've got that live event on March 12th in Toronto on the network, and they've already announced it's going to be Brock against Luke Harper. They've already tipped their cap as far as what they're going to be doing with Brock after this pay-per-view. Wyatts have to win. They're my pick to win. Sasha Banks and Becky Lynch against Naomi and Tamina. Sasha and Becky, they get the win. You know, I suppose they could do the unwilling partners thing and they cost each other the match and it doesn't really hurt them. But I still think they're going to win. And I think that leads to a 3-way at WrestleMania for the title with Charlotte, Sasha, and Becky. And I think they have to win for that reason, because if they lose, then all of a sudden Naomi and Tamina you know, they could lay claim to the championship, and I don't want them doing a four-way or a six-way or something like that at WrestleMania. They have to do either one-on-one or a triple threat with Charlotte, Sasha, and Becky. So you've got to position them as the number one contenders, which means they have to win. So they're my pick. We're also getting the Cutting Edge Peep Show. Edge and Christian's new show on the network debuts tonight after Fastlane, so they're going to have them there to promote it. They're going to do a talk show segment. Their guests are The New Day. And it's time. It's time for Enzo Amore and Colin Cassidy to come on down. It's time for them to make their debut, especially since the Usos are all tied up with the Dudley Boys right now. Someone new needs to step up and challenge The New Day for the tag team titles, and it ain't going to be Edge and Christian. And since Kenny Omega and the Young Bucks are all tied up in New Japan and they can't do it, I think Kaz and Enzo are the next logical choice. We know that Jason Jordan and Chad Gable are the ones getting the shot at Dash and Dawson in Dallas at TakeOver. They're getting the next tag title match. So that leaves no obvious role for these guys. If they're not challenging for the NXT tag belts, then what are they there for? What are they doing? There's no obvious role for them unless the two of them get demoted to the main roster, and I think this is where it happens. I think it happens tonight. They've relegated the U.S. Championship match to the pre-show. Now, you have two ways of looking at this. On the one hand, John Cena no longer holds the championship, and so therefore it's no longer a priority, and that's why it's on the pre-show. On the other hand, if I'm trying to be optimistic about this, you could look at it and go, well, the pre-show match, in theory, is the match they use to hook people into wanting to buy the pay-per-view. So if you put on this great match on the pre-show, it gets people excited. More people might be likely to sign up for the network or buy the pay-per-view and watch the show. I don't know how true that is, because it's not like they've given us many pre-show matches to get excited about, but maybe that's why they did it. It's a 2 out of 3 falls match, Kalisto and Alberto Del Rio. Don't take the title off Kalisto. I could easily see them doing that. I hope they don't. Kalisto's my pick. Hopefully he'll hold on to it. He'll move on. I'm still holding out hope there's a chance that they could do something with him and Neville at WrestleMania. But please, just don't take the title off the guy. You need to promote new guys. You need some fresh blood. Make them feel special. This is not the time to be knocking this guy back down the ladder. Just, you know, keep him strong. Give him a big win. Let him move on. Defend it at WrestleMania. That's the right way to go. And I think he'll retain. Raw, this past Monday night, was live from Anaheim, California. Raw Instapoll on Twitter. 1,500-plus votes. 14% thumbs up, 39% thumbs down, 47% of you said, meh. Meh. That sounds about right. When Stephanie came out at the beginning and she announced the Fatal 5-Way at the top of the show for the Intercontinental title, I tweeted out, I said, there's still a chance to get that title back on Kevin Owens for a match against Sami Zayn at WrestleMania. Well, one half of my wish was granted, because Kevin Owens, as mentioned earlier, is the new Intercontinental Champion. He pinned Tyler Breeze to beat Breeze, Ambrose, Stardust, and Dolph Ziggler. Why Stardust was in this match, don't ask me. I don't even remember the last time he won a match. But there he was. This was the best thing on the entire show. They peaked early. I liked the match. I like that they got people to think that because Ambrose dropped the title, maybe he actually has a shot at winning at Fastlane, so this was good. And then my cable went out. And actually, I should correct that. USA Network went out. Every single other channel worked fine. I have hundreds of channels, I don't even know what they are. Every single channel worked except USA. And this wasn't like a national problem. There were other people who were having issues. It may have just been an East Coast, New York, New Jersey issue, although I think I had one, I think Brad, who's listening right now, who's down in Texas, I think he may have had an issue also. So I don't know what the hell happened. Some people had the channel, some people didn't. I know in New York and New Jersey, we got shut out. Most of us did anyway. I figured the reason that this must have happened is they were promoting the Big Show against Braun Strowman for later on in the show. And so initially what I thought is my TV killed itself. You know, it died to protect me. But then it came back on, so I did miss the Mark Henry Big E match where Henry got hurt. I saw a video of what happened. Big E, basically, he got him up on his shoulder for the big ending, and Henry just shoved himself off and fell to the mat in agony. And Big E covered him and got the pin. And Henry tweeted out later on, he hurt his rib, I'll live. It's not too serious. I don't think anything's broken necessarily. He'll be okay. Hopefully he doesn't have to miss WrestleMania because I still want him to win that Battle Royal. I'm still pulling for him to get the big win. I know they supposedly have Braun Strowman pegged to win the Andre Battle Royal at WrestleMania. That's the latest rumor. Fuck that. Tell the Mark Henry story on TV. Like, after Fastlane is over, they can start telling the story. And they've mentioned it before, that Henry's thinking he's going to be, his career is winding down. And in interviews, Henry's flat out said that he's not re-signing with the company. Vince McMahon talked him into signing a new 3-year deal 3 years ago. He doesn't know how he did it, but he did, and he's not doing that again. And after WrestleMania, he's done. Or sometime after WrestleMania, maybe not the day after, but sometime after WrestleMania, he's done. It's over. So we know his career is coming to an end. He's been around for 20 years. This is the 20th anniversary of this guy's career. The timing could not be more perfect to tell this story. And at this point, the guy is being held together by rubber bands and scotch tape. Let him win the damn thing so he can, you can get a good story out of it, and he can call it a day and ride off into the sunset. My only other question is, what the fuck is he in there taking a big ending for? I understand they're trying to use him to get other people over. Mark Henry should not be taking moves like that. Not at this point. He should not be leaving his feet. I heard there was a promo here between Brie Bella and Charlotte. My cable went out, so I didn't see it, and I didn't go back to watch it, so I can't comment on it. AJ Styles beat The Miz with the Calf Crusher. It was a good match. This was a real good match. Jericho was out there on commentary. Jericho and Big Show have to be two of the best guys on the active roster that I've heard do color commentary. Big Show did it a few times on SmackDown way back when, and if he wants to do it when he does retire, they need to boot JBL off this show and put him in there. After the match, AJ cut his first real in-ring promo in a WWE ring. He did well, except for some of the inbred morons in the crowd who gave him the what treatment. And he wasn't the only person who got the what treatment on this show. I saw one report that said the same group of guys that started whatting him here were cheering him 5 minutes before this. It's like Undertaker said that one time on Raw. Say what if you sleep with your sister? Inbred morons. That's what they are. Paul Heyman called out Roman Reigns so that he could address him face to face. Roman was booed hard this week. This was not a good Roman Reigns town. This was not one of the more favorable cities that he's found himself in. The booing is not as bad as it was 3 months ago, but it's very much still there. Heyman plays mind games with him. He tells him at Fastlane, Roman has to choose between his wife and daughter or his best friend. Friends or family, which is it going to be? And Roman thanked him and said he has no problem fighting his brother. He beat Ambrose once, he'll do it again. He says he's never beaten Brock, but he's beaten his ass. And then they shook hands and Heyman walked away. No sooner did Heyman walk away than the Dudley boys came out to attack from behind. And at that moment, I got really excited because I thought, oh, they're aligning the Dudleys with Heyman. That's pretty cool. But then it became pretty obvious that it was just a one-time thing. They only did it as a way to tease a tag team match to set up on SmackDown with Roman and Dean against the Dudleys. So, oh well. It was good for the 30 seconds that I thought that's the direction they were going in. Ambrose ran out to make the save. When he shook hands with Roman, he went for dirty deeds. Fans cheered. Roman shoved him away, and the crowd booed. It could not be any more apparent who the fans would rather see wrestling Triple H in that main event of WrestleMania. But they have their guy, and by God, they know what we want better than we do. So after the shock wore off, Roman smiled like, yeah, you almost got me. He should have dropped him with a spear right then and there. I apparently have more killer instinct than Roman Reigns. Maybe I should be the one going for the title at WrestleMania. They announced that this Monday, the first ever Vincent J. McMahon Legacy of Excellence Award will be presented. They say it is the most prestigious award they've ever given, and no one has deserved it until now. This screams Angle to me. I don't think it's a real award. I think it's being awarded to Triple H. That's my pick. We got a great Black History Month video on Booker T. Cheap plug, you can listen to Booker on this very podcast, episode 417, in the archives if you missed it, or you can go on YouTube. Your main event on this final illustrious edition of Raw before Fastlane was The Big Show against Braun Strowman. And I can't even call this the worst match I saw all week because I watched that Bellator fight with Kimbo Slice and Dada 5000. Holy shit. We even got a flare flop for the finish. That, seriously, like all joking aside, that was one of the most amazing things I've ever seen. Amazing for all the wrong reasons. And I'm so happy I flipped it on and I watched it. Dada's heart apparently stopped beating at the hospital. He ended up on a ventilator. All because he cut 40 pounds. I think the guy was like 300 or 301 was his weight prior to this. And he lost 40 pounds. He kind of cut 40 pounds leading up to this match. 40 pounds in how long? I don't know. I don't know if it was 40 pounds in 2 weeks or 3 weeks. But that's a lot of weight to cut at once. Fucking guy almost died because of weight cutting. How is that even allowed? How is something like that even allowed? I mean, they have athletic commissions for a reason, don't they? Unbelievable. So anyway, Big Show and Strowman main event made no sense for a couple of reasons. First of all, you might have been able to get away with this 20 years ago when Raw was an hour long and we didn't always get the best main events. I remember main events like Undertaker and Damian Demento and shit like that, okay? It's not like Raw main events back in 93 and 94 were always so great, okay? You might have been able to get away with that then when Raw was a 60-minute show, but since that time, USA Network has stuck the steroid needle in Raw's ass and expanded it to 3 hours. That's what this show is now. This is Raw on steroids. And what happens to a lot of guys after years and years and lots of steroids? They drop dead. This show is not going to be dropping dead anytime soon, but it is dying a slow death if you look at the ratings. Okay, and although according to Vince McMahon on the last investor call, the ratings don't matter anymore. Yeah, they don't matter. They don't matter. It's like politicians and poll numbers. When the poll numbers go up, the polls say I'm in first place. The polls. When the polls show them in like third place or fourth place, the polls, they don't know what they're talking about. It's just a poll. Who cares? It's the same thing. If Raw was doing fours and fives every week, Vince McMahon, they couldn't crank out the press releases quick enough. But the fact that the Raw ratings overall are in the shitter right now, well, the ratings, they don't matter. And he's right in this respect. They're locked into this escalating deal with USA or Viacom or whatever. Or not Viacom, but NBC Universal. So they're actually going to make more money over the next 2-3 years as the deal goes on. They're going to make more money. So in that respect, he's not totally wrong. But, the ratings, they don't matter. Yeah, they don't matter until their deal with USA comes due in a few years. Then it's going to matter a whole lot. But he must really believe that. Vince McMahon must really believe what he says there because just look at the main event they gave us here. Does this main event not scream to you, the ratings don't matter? So the Wyatts run in for the DQ. The only good thing I can say about this, you know, and look, I'm not bashing the Big Show or Braun Strowman. They go in there, they do what they're told to do, and Strowman, I actually think Strowman gets some unfair criticism when people talk about, Braun Strowman and blah, 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 when there were rumors of him and The Undertaker at WrestleMania, which thankfully was just a rumor. It may have been the plan, but it's changed, I guess, so that's not going to happen, thank God. But people were like, this may end up being the worst WrestleMania match of all time. Like, did you people forget about the giant Gonzalez? Did you people forget about Kamala and The Undertaker and some of The Undertaker's worst feuds? Undertaker and King Kong fucking Bundy? Braun Strowman actually is not that bad. I actually think Strowman could probably get a better match out of The Undertaker than King Kong Bundy in 1995 or the Giant Gonzalez in 1993. So I actually kind of feel bad for the guy. I'm not beating up on him that much. Let's not take things too far here. But to take these two guys and put them in a match in the main event after I've sat through, I mean, my cable went out, so technically 2.5 hours, but yeah, I've sat through this entire show. You hope they're building to something big at the end, and they give you Big Show and Braun Strowman. And the only thing I could say about this, it was short. I don't know how long it went. It was 2-3 minutes maybe. Wyatt's ran in for the DQ. Ryback ran down for the save. Inexplicably, when he charged at Luke Harper, Harper turned it into a sunset flip in the aisle. I have no idea what that was about. Kane emerged from the fiery depths of TNA underneath the ring. He and Big Show gave Harper a double choke slam. The other reason the placement of this match made no sense is because the scheduled guest on the Stone Cold podcast immediately after Raw was the Big Show. So this poor bastard, they go live to Steve Austin in the back. He's sitting there all by himself, and now he's got to stall, and he's got to wait for this 400-pound guy to lumber his way down the hallway to the back. So he starts talking about Daniel Bryan. He sends well wishes to Bret Hart, and then he says, "I am sitting here waiting for the Big Show. I will continue to talk until such time that my guest decides to show up." It was comical, and then when he finally gets there, Big Show is totally gassed. He's dripping like a faucet. He can barely catch his breath. They should put an oxygen mask on him. Oh, yeah, great planning. Great planning. I will say this, though. The last hour of Raw would have been far better. It would not have been such a shit show had they just replaced it with Steve Austin interviewing the Big Show. I get that it's a network thing and all that, but they should have just taken that and made that the third hour of Raw, and it would have been infinitely better. I have no interest in seeing Big Show wrestle these days, but I can listen to him talk all day long. The guy is great in these types of settings. This was the best Stone Cold podcast they've done yet. The best. I loved it. I'd rank it number one. I'd put the Vince one at number two and the Triple H one at number three. You know, and if you have a bias against the Big Show, you hate the Big Show's guts, I would say put that aside, watch this interview. It really is that good. At one point, Austin asked him about how he would sum up the booking of his character throughout his entire WWE career, and the Big Show called the booking horrendous. You know, he's talking about his own booking, not the general WWE booking. You could possibly say the same thing. He said he's been a victim of his own success because they're always trying to find the next big fix, and he's always been a team player, and he's willing to go along with whatever Vince wants him to do. And he's admitted he's had more turns than NASCAR. He's turned from heel to heel to face about 30 times. Austin found an old photo of the Big Show's dad back around the time, I guess, he was suffering from cancer. And the Big Show, this was the saddest part of the whole interview, because they have the picture up on the screen. Big Show turns and he's like, "Oh, there it is. That's my dad." And he just loses it. He hadn't seen this photo in many, many, many years. He started kind of laughing, like giggling, like he couldn't believe that they found that photo. He hadn't seen it in so long. And then his eyes just well up with tears. It was pretty rough to watch. And it's even rougher when you think, it made me think, you know, Big Show's father. What does that remind you of? It reminds you of the storyline they did in 99. Now, I'm going to assume that Big Show's father had already died by that point, you know, in real life, but they did that storyline with Big Show and the Big Boss Man, which I will admit is a favorite of mine, because I found it immensely entertaining, very funny. They did a storyline with the two of them where Boss Man was mocking the fact that, you know, in storyline, Big Show's father had died. And they made it seem like it had just happened. And I think back to that whole thing now and the Boss Man poem, which I thought was just hilarious, but I'm sitting here watching Big Show just lose it, looking at a picture of his dad and how it was really bad toward the end. His cancer had come back. You know, I don't know what kind of cancer it was, but in that Boss Man poem, he has that line. He says, "If I had a son as stupid as you, I'd have wished for cancer so I would die too." I mean, holy shit. That gives it a whole new context now. That's rough. That's pretty rough. He talked about Hulk Hogan helping him get into WCW. He told a great story about working with Austin in Germany at a house show once, and he dropped an F-bomb in there somewhere during the interview. Big Show, he was drinking Austin's new beer. Austin has a new IPA out. And Austin brought him as a gift. He said, "Here." And Big Show was all excited, and he was like, "You know, am I allowed to drink this?" And Austin's like, "Well, I don't know. You got to check with VKM, but you're a giant, so you can do whatever you want." So Big Show says, "Yeah, I'm going to kayfabe it." He would hold up a towel. So every time he would take a swig of the beer, he was kind of blocking the view. You know, let's not harm the children now. God forbid they see Big Show drinking beer. It's not like Austin never did that on TV or anything like that. So he kept holding the towel up to block the view. It became like a funny thing. I just love how this guy is so worried about drinking a beer on TV. He holds up a towel to block our view, but then 5 minutes later, he just casually drops an F-bomb. this was great. I really hope they didn't edit that out. There were people telling me when I was asking on, I was asking people like those who have checked the network. I don't know why I'm asking. I could have just checked it myself. Fucking lazy ass I am. But people were telling me on Monday or on Tuesday morning that the F-bomb and all that was still in there. So I don't know if they've gone back now and edited that out, but whether they did or they didn't, I highly advise you to go back and check it out. It's well worth your time. Like I said, Raw would have been a much better show had they not forced me to sit through 4 hours of television, and they would have just aired this in that third hour.
I'm actually not wearing pants, and that's how I watch NXT every single week.
If you haven't seen the video of Finn Balor dressed up as Bayley from the NXT show in Albany last night, you need to go watch it. It's fucking great. At least until Vince sees it and debuts the guy on the main roster as Finn Bayley. Then it won't be so great anymore. Enzo Amore and Colin Cassidy teamed up with American Alpha. They beat the NXT Tag Team Champions Dash and Dawson and Blake and Murphy. 8-man tag to open the show. The formula in all these matches, whether it's an American Alpha tag match or an 8-man tag that they're in, the formula is always the same. Chad Gable starts, he does some great wrestling, some great chain wrestling, and then the heels cut him off, and they get the heat, and they beat him down, and they beat him down, and they beat him down, and then eventually he makes the hot tag, and it works. This was fun. Asuka beat Deonna Purrazzo after 3 spinning back fists and a spin kick of death. Rest in peace, Deonna. Ty Dillinger beat Triple H cosplay. That's what I wrote down here. That's what he is. Go back and watch this, okay? Watch Alex Riley's entrance when he comes down and he's standing there and they're filming him from behind. Just look at him and look at the green laser lights and just tell me that's not Triple H. Tell me he is not morphing into Triple H. Ty Dillinger pinned him with a roll-up. That, I guess, is only going to fill Riley with even more rage that he's already filled with. You know what's completely fucked about this is Dillinger is supposed to be the heel, and Riley's supposed to be the face. At least they think that's the idea. It's not really working out that way. This is what I wanted to talk about. Finn Balor cut a ridiculous promo. I don't even know what he said, because I was too distracted, wondering who the fuck he was looking at off-screen the entire time. Seriously, this was so stupid. Why do they force them to do that? Why? Someone tell me why. Go back and watch this and tell me that this does not look completely and utterly ridiculous. They do this with everybody. But for some reason, I'm watching this and it stood out to me more. I don't know if it's because this guy is the champion, but he's being interviewed, and every now and then he'll turn to look at the interviewer. Okay, that I can understand. I'd still say look in the camera, look at me. But okay, fine, he's looking at the interviewer. But then he turns, and he's not looking at us. He's looking that way. He's looking off camera. And what it looks like is that he's reading cue cards. Now, I assume that all of these guys are not reading cue cards, so why the fuck are they looking off screen, off into the distance? It looks ridiculous. I was infuriated by this. And I don't even know why. Again, it's not like this is the first time they've done this, but I'm watching this and I'm like, this is absurd. Nobody watching this recognizes how ridiculous this looks. There isn't anybody there who says, hey, why is he looking there? Or maybe we should have him look here? Or like, what's going on here? Nobody questions this. I'm floored. I'm just floored by this. Sami Zayn and Samoa Joe in the main event. Winner becomes number one contender for the NXT title. Started out slow. Got real good toward the end. Ended with the old finish Shawn Michaels and Triple H used on Raw back in 2003. Michaels hit the super kick and fell on top of Triple H, but both of their shoulders were down on the mat. I actually brought that match up on YouTube. And, you know, when I saw this and I made the comparison, I brought it up on YouTube. I didn't watch the whole thing. It was like divided into two parts. I watched part two. And I'm just watching the finish of that match with Jim Ross calling it, as only Jim Ross can. And it brought me back. And it's like, God damn, this show is missing Jim Ross. It's like, oh man, I miss that. I miss calls like, and it's cool that he's coming back to TV. You know, he's going to be doing the Access TV shows for New Japan. That's awesome. It'll be good to hear him back calling wrestling matches again. But man, it really, when you go back and watch, and that match in particular had a great call there at the end because they thought Shawn won the title, and it was a great moment. And the call was even better. So anyway, that's kind of what this reminded me of. This time it was the Huluva kick in the corner. Zayn falls on top of Joe. Drake Younger counts the three, ends up declaring the match a draw. So yet another disputed finish between these two. Good cliffhanger ending. William Regal now has to make a decision on how he's going to resolve this because we need a number one contender. By the way, I almost forgot. There's a little Sami Zayn Easter egg. I'm sure most of you have probably seen this, but this is cool enough I wanted to mention it anyway. A little Easter egg for those who don't know. If you go to Google Translate and do English to Arabic translation, type in Sami Zayn and then transpose that back to English, you get El Generico. Try it out. It's pretty cool. This Wednesday on NXT, it's going to be Baymella. That's what they call themselves, Carmella and Bayley against Eva Marie and Nia Jax. Eva Marie and Nia Jax, I completely missed that. They had a promo on this show, too. This one actually didn't bother me. You know why? Because they were looking in the camera. So I completely forgave however awful Eva Marie may have been in this promo, and I don't think she was that bad. She was what you would expect. Yeah, very cardboard sounding. But I'm okay with that. I'm okay with that because not everybody is a great promo, but at least they looked into the fucking camera. Lucha Underground, Episode 4. One of our listeners, Greg, wanted to give him credit. He wrote in with this fun little fact. It's funny, last week I was thinking to myself, I didn't mention this in the review, but I was thinking, you know, what happened to the bands? They would have like a house band playing every week to start the show in Season 1. They would have different bands. None so far in Season 2, and I kind of miss that. Well, Greg says, if you were wondering what happened to the bands from Season 1 and you have not yet read the Lucha Underground comic book, the Disciples of Death killed them and used their skulls to build Mil Muertes' throne. Cool. Ivelisse, Son of Havoc, and Angelico against Chavo Guerrero and the crew. Remember now, Cortez Castro is an undercover cop. That's what we learned last week. Matt Stryker said Mr. Cisco is such a bad dude, he'll cut you with a box cutter. I think Mr. Cisco's been hanging around the New York City subways lately. I've had about 15 random slashings so far this year. I don't know what the hell's going on. Angelico is great. He'd be a great fit for that global cruiserweight series that WWE is doing, but he's under contract here, so I know it can't happen. He got the win with a double foot stomp on Castro. After the match, Chavo's chewing out the crew in the ring when Tejano runs down with a bull rope and runs them off. In the back, Joey Ryan, the other undercover cop, is mocking Castro after his loss and tells him to watch my match next to see how it's done. Unfortunately for him, his opponent is, they call him Cage. Ryan, actually, he held his own here for a while. He was doing well. Cage, though, gave him the old Steiner screwdriver for the win. It looked far more terrifying when Scott Steiner would do it, but still not a move I would want to be taking. Johnny Mundo attacked Cage after the match. Cage ends up giving him Weapon X, which does look cool, but it remains the most convoluted-looking finisher in all of wrestling. Cage and Mundo are going to have a match next week. We get a vignette with Rey Mysterio sparring with Dragon Azteca Jr. Story time. Rey tells him that 25 years ago, Dario Cueto's father met Dragon Azteca, and the two of them had one goal in mind, which was to unite the 7 Aztec tribes. Dario's father fell to the dark side and started making human sacrifices. He even sacrificed his own son, Matanza, to one of the gods. Now Rey says their goal, I guess him and Dragon Azteca Jr., their goal is to unite the tribes. Apparently, Prince Puma is one of the descendants of those 7 ancient tribes. That's what Matt Stryker told us. What that means, I don't know. Are all 7 descendants supposed to hold hands and sing Kumbaya? I don't know. I don't know what the end goal is here. Main event was Prince Puma and Pentagon Jr. Got a huge Cero Miedo chant from the crowd, then dueling chants of Let's Go Puma, Cero Miedo. Pentagon told the crowd to be quiet at one point and delivered, like, no joke, the loudest fucking knife-edge chop I've ever heard in my entire life. How he even had skin left on his chest is a mystery to me. Rest of the match was pretty back and forth. Crowd was into it. Finish was very similar, actually, to the finish we saw at NXT this week. Pentagon gave him a package pile driver, and then instead of going for the pin, he goes for a surfboard. And in the surfboard, he pulls Puma's shoulders back down to the mat while still holding the move, and seemingly he's got him pinned. Ref counts three, but then the referee awards the match to Puma, because Puma got his shoulder up at the last second. Pentagon, unbeknownst to him, his own shoulders were down. And so that was the finish they did. Pentagon gives the referee a kick after the match, knocks him down. Puma then gives him a kick to the head, and he teases breaking Pentagon's arm like he's broken everybody else's arm, but he backs off. And the show ends with Sexy Star apparently having escaped the clutches of Marty the Moth. She's back at the temple running down a hallway, and she just looks all hysterical. This is all being done in slow motion, by the way. And she runs into the Mac. And Willie Mac's telling her to calm down. Who did this to you? And she says, Moth. And Mac just goes, I'm going to kill him. Sexy stops him and says, no, not him. Her. And she points to what I assume is Marty's sister. We've heard Marty the Moth mention a sister before. We haven't been introduced to her yet. I assume that's who was standing behind the Mac, because the Mac turns around and his eyes get all wide and they fade to black. I'm still sitting here just waiting to find out what Matanza looks like. That's what I want to know. I hear they're supposedly looking to film a Lucha Underground movie to come out sometime in 2018. I fully endorse that idea. I think it would totally flop if they put it out in theaters. But if they wanted to air it on El Rey, or they wanted to put it out like by digital download or something like that, I would love to watch a Lucha Underground movie. I think of TV shows that should have been made into a movie, and it makes me sad because I keep coming back to The Sopranos. They totally could have done a movie. Now they can't. See what happens? This is what happens when you wait too long. People die. Now we're never going to get to see one. Makes me very sad. Anyway, time for the mailbag. If you have questions, you can email me, thesolomonster@gmail.com. Please include your name and where you are from. Chris from Green Bay had a story he wanted to share. It's not a question, but it's actually pretty cool, so I wanted to read it here. This is his own words. I'll just read this. He says, I was born in the winter of 1978, and Wisconsin had a record-breaking snowfall that year. We're talking snow up to the top of the telephone poles, well over 7 or 8 feet. We lived in, I can't even pronounce this, Manitowoc? I hope that's the right way to pronounce that. Lived in Manitowoc at the time, which is just south of Green Bay, and a few blocks from our house was the arena that the AWA would do shows in. Well, this past weekend, I'm helping my mom go through stuff in her basement and come across these old Super 8 videos, and one of them says, Record Snowfall of 1978, so I fire up the projector and the video shows the crazy snow outside. Our neighbor is stuck in the road and can't get her car out, and my mom is taping all of this. All of a sudden, these guys come over to help, and I notice one is wearing an AWA jacket. I look closer, and it's Greg Gagne. The AWA had a show that day and came over to help our neighbor get unstuck. In the video, I can also pick out Jesse Ventura, Blackjack Lanza, Dino Bravo, and Iron Sheik. There's some other guys I don't recognize, but there's something like 10 wrestlers helping this lady get her car out. I asked my mom about this, and she says, oh yeah, these wrestlers helped our neighbor get unstuck and even had dinner at their house that same night. All this time, those Super 8 videos were in the basement, and I had no idea that it ever happened. Just wanted to share this cool story. Well, that is a cool story, and actually, Chris told me that once they're converted, he'll share them with me. So I look forward to that. Chris from Gary, Indiana. I'm sure you've heard the rumors that The Undertaker's opponent at WrestleMania will not be someone currently on the active roster. Who is your best guess as to who it might be? Well, that comes from a report in the Wrestling Observer, for those who don't know. The belief is that The Undertaker's opponent has been chosen, and it is not somebody on the WWE roster. Now, not on the active roster is a tricky thing. I mean, would John Cena be considered active roster since he's out hurt right now? I don't know. Because Cena's on Twitter, he's posting cryptic tweets that makes you think he's coming back. And look, I've said for over a month now, don't count him out for WrestleMania. If he wrestles, he's wrestling The Undertaker. If he's not wrestling, the next logical answer is Sting. But I just can't see it. I mean, the guy's got spinal stenosis. The doctors told him you need neck surgery. He's 56, going on 57. I just don't see it. How do you clear him? How do you let the guy wrestle? They're so overprotective of guys now with these injuries. How does that happen? So you start thinking of some other names. Batista? You know, after the Titus O'Neil stuff, I don't see any way he would even appear at WrestleMania, so you could forget that. Kurt Angle, he's got that match with Rey Mysterio next month on some indie show. I don't think they'd be letting him do that if he signed a deal with WWE. Goldberg? You know, I mean, I just don't see it. I just don't see it. If it's someone not on the roster, honestly, the name I would love to see step back in there one more time and wrestle Undertaker, and it is Texas after all, Shawn Michaels. I hear the two of them had a pretty decent match the last time WrestleMania came to Texas. I can't verify this, but that's what people tell me. Joey from South Carolina, with Kane and Neville recently working as a tag team on house shows, I'm curious, would you have any interest in seeing the two of them as a permanent duo? I know it's not ideal for Neville, but it is better than just toiling in the mid-card for all eternity. Plus, Kane has had four successful tag teams with smaller guys in the past, so why not another? My first instinct when I hear that is to say no, but then I look at what they've got Neville doing now, which is next to nothing. And I think about Team Hell No. Daniel Bryan teamed with Kane for a while, and that didn't hurt him too bad. It was actually very entertaining, and Bryan still went on to bigger and better things. You know, I've been a fan of Kane teaming with smaller guys before. You guys know I was a big fan of Kane and X-Pac. I even like Kane and X-Pac more than Team Hell No. So I'm not against the idea. I'm actually okay with it. If they wanted to try it out on TV, fine. Me personally, I'd rather book Neville in a series with Kalisto coming out of Fastlane, build that for WrestleMania, or do a series and have the final match between them at WrestleMania, make that U.S. title fun. But if not, then teaming with Kane would not be so bad. I mean, at least it gets him featured on TV. Kane is bulletproof. The thing about Kane is, and he's like Big Show, heel to face, the heel to face, corporate Kane, demon Kane, semen Kane, whatever. You know, the guy's always going to be over no matter what they do with him. It keeps him out of the main event picture, which is what I want, and it keeps Neville in the mix on TV. So, why not? D from England, I've always wondered why the fans turned on The Rock at SummerSlam 2002, even though he was the babyface champion. Looking back, it confused me, because the only time I understood him being booed was WrestleMania 18 in Toronto, where fans loved Hogan. But Lesnar was a heel, not being cheered in his feud with The Rock. Why did fans boo Rock? And also, could Rock have been a good heel champion in 2003 if he had stayed longer? Well, that, absolutely. Hollywood Rock. That's my favorite incarnation of The Rock. Hollywood Rock, corporate Rock. It's a shame. It's a crime. He couldn't stay longer than he did. It kind of reminds me of Batista, in all honesty, in 2010, I guess it would have been. Once Batista went heel, and he was the champ, and he came out there, he looked like one of the fucking village people, he had the black vest, and just, he was great. He was the closest thing to, like, a Hollywood Rock type, and same thing with him, it just didn't last long. They took the belt off of him, put it on Cena, because he was leaving a couple months later. I wish both of those guys would have had, like, another 6 months, like, with the title to just do their thing. As far as why Rock got booed, I think it was a combination of a few different things. I think the biggest thing probably was they were in New York. It was at the Nassau Coliseum, so you get that, you know, the New York crowd, so to speak. But also, I think people knew Rock was leaving. I mean, he was going away again to film more movies. I think there was some resentment there. And also, Brock was a fucking beast. Yeah, it's amazing that when you take somebody and you book them like a monster and you keep them strong, fans tend to like guys like that. We've seen it now. Look at the way they booked Brock. What did Brock do? In the time that he went from clearly being a heel to clearly being cheered by people, what did he do differently? What, did he come out and start handing out free gifts to people in the crowd? No, he doesn't give a fuck about you. He doesn't give a fuck about me. Heyman was still out there cutting the same promos he always did. Nothing changed. But the guy was booked like a freaking unstoppable monster, and people got behind him. And also, you know, I'm sure it helped that he wasn't on TV every week. But that's why people started to get behind him. So Lesnar in 2002, he was an animal. He was a machine, and he was running through everybody. He ran through the Hardy Boys. He ran through RVD. He beat Hulk Hogan on SmackDown with a bear hug. I mean, he was going through people left and right. And he was a force to be reckoned with. So I think it was all of those things. I don't think it was just one. It was the perfect storm. Brock's a monster. People know Rock is leaving. You're in New York. It's a recipe for disaster, and that's what happened to The Rock. So I think that's your answer. Dylan Laporte from Windsor, Ontario. I just listened to your review on Hardcore Holly's book, The Hardcore Truth. My question is, do you believe Hardcore will be in the WWE Hall of Fame one day? As you said in your review, he spoke very honestly and sometimes critically of WWE, in particular Triple H. So could that sour his chances despite his 15 years with the company? Also, do you think he actually had the world's greatest dropkick? Well, if he didn't, he had one of the best. Hardcore Holly had one of the best dropkicks I've ever seen. Dolph Ziggler has a great dropkick. Randy Orton has one of the best. I'm sure there are others, maybe some other indie guys coming up, but those are the guys I think of, and Hardcore Holly is in that top three. He had a beautiful dropkick. I don't know if it was the best, but it was great. As far as in the Hall of Fame, I look at it like this. You know, it's a WWE Hall of Fame. I know they put people in from all over, but it's a WWE Hall of Fame. What contributions did this guy give to the company? He started out, you know, almost like an enhancement guy, really. I mean, he was winning matches, which is more than I can say for, you know, guys like, I mean, Barry Horowitz got a little bit of a push in 95, but he was a job guy. Holly was winning matches. He wasn't really a featured player. But then he had like a tag title run. I think it was him and the 1-2-3 Kid. He had some matches on TV with like Goldust or whatever for the IC title. In the Attitude Era, that's really where he got a chance to shine. I was very entertained by the super heavyweight stuff. He'd come out with the scale thinking he's 400 pounds standing up to the Big Show and Kane and the APA, slapping him around. It was fucking great. I loved it. And then he transitioned into the hardcore stuff. And the 24/7 hardcore stuff was one of the most entertaining things about the Attitude Era. I mean, the stuff with him and Al Snow and the Boss Man, I mean, I love that stuff. And Holly was one of the most successful hardcore champions that they ever had. He was right in the mix. He was right in the middle of all that stuff at a time when, I mean, the company was never hotter. You know, and he was, you know, not a main eventer, but he was one of the featured guys on that roster during the hottest period in the company's existence. And then after that, you know, he was still there for many, many years. You know, they had him as part of Tough Enough, and, you know, we know the stuff with him as one of the judges or the trainers and what he did to Matt Capitelli and that whole controversy and people calling him a bully and that kind of stuff. But I look at his career and I say to myself, here's a guy who spent every bit of, what was it, 15, 20 years in that company. That's a long stretch of time. There are very few guys that have had that kind of run in WWE. I mean, Billy Gunn is another one, Undertaker, Kane, and Holly's in that group. He's in that league. That's how much, you know, time served he had in that company. He held championships. He had some memorable matches. To me, you know, that qualifies him for the WWE Hall of Fame. There's no set voting criteria. You don't have to have X number of titles. You don't have to be a main eventer who drew millions of dollars. There's a lot of guys who I think are at his level who are in the Hall of Fame who, you know, are justifiably in the Hall of Fame. And I think Holly, you know, fits in that same class. So if they put him in the Hall of Fame one day, I got no problem with that. Now, will they put him in the Hall of Fame? I don't see it. I don't think it's going to happen. But what I'm saying is if they did, I wouldn't have a problem with it. Chris from Arizona, what are your thoughts on the Three Stages of Hell match in No Way Out 2001 between Stone Cold Steve Austin and Triple H? Thought it was a great match. I thought it was pointless after the fact. You know, hindsight looking back at it. You had Triple H pin Steve Austin clean. He beat him. Austin went to WrestleMania. He won the championship. Triple H lost to Undertaker, but he still had a win over Austin. He had a win over the champion. And he came out on Raw the next night. People were getting behind him. He was like starting a babyface turn. Then they did the swerve, and he hit Rock, and he ended up being partners with Austin. And I have to go back and refresh my memory, because there was some political stuff going on at the time. You know, Rock was going away to do a movie. I remember reading that I think the plan had been for Triple H to, you know, with Rock going away, let's turn Triple H to fill that void and have him challenge Austin for the championship. And you could do that program for the next few months. And that may have been why they gave Triple H that win in February over Austin. And what may have happened, and again, I could be wrong about this, but I vaguely remember, you know, Triple H nixed the idea. He didn't want to be Austin's opponent. He wanted to stay heel. And so he ended up becoming partners with Austin, which is interesting because Austin was still the hottest guy in the company. And I think Triple H probably knew, okay, if I feud with Austin, he just won the title, I'm not taking the title away from him. Or if I do, it's going right back to Austin. So I'm just going to, you know, I'll work some main events with him, and then Austin's going to move on to the next opponent, and then what happens to me? I could see, you know, that point of view coming from him. And so instead, we see Austin now aligned with Triple H as though they're equals. And of course, they've never been equals. Austin was always a level above. But now all of a sudden, they're positioned as equals. And Triple H, I mean, if you watch a lot of those segments and promos, it was Triple H who was taking the lead. It was Triple H who was almost positioned as like the leader of the pack in a way. Now, they gave the Intercontinental title to Triple H. I'm sure that thrilled him to have the secondary title. But it was just interesting how instead of challenging Austin, which would have seemed like the thing to do, he beat the guy, Rock is gone, you need baby faces. Instead, they had a shoehorn Undertaker and Kane in there as the top baby faces for 2-3 months. And they put Triple H with Austin as a team, and it was like, you know, hey, we're on the same level here. And I never saw them as being on the same level. So that's why I think the whole three stages of hell thing was completely pointless. It made no sense. Now, maybe if Triple H didn't get hurt, maybe they would have ended up doing that anyway. Maybe the big SummerSlam main event would have been Austin and Triple H, and they would have built it up for that, and they could have come back to the whole fact that, hey, I beat you before WrestleMania. You know, I'll cut them some slack because maybe that was the plan. And then Triple H tore his quad and everything went to hell. It's very possible. But I always found that a little odd. AJ from Arizona, another Arizona guy. What are your thoughts on Paige's recent comments about the term diva and the diva's title? This is what Paige said. She said, as much as I came here and I was like, I want to change that, when you think about a WWE diva, you think of us girls in WWE. Not like the girls that are in the indies or in TNA or other companies. So yeah, the word diva means a lot to me. But just redesign the diva's belt because that butterfly sucks. When did the term become a problem to everyone? I say that because no one raised an issue about it when Trish and Lita competed. They were called divas with no outrage. I'm asking this question to understand why the term carries a negative connotation now as opposed to back then, even though I disagree with what Paige said, considering she once called herself the anti-diva. Or is it WWE's way of making Paige put over the term diva to look good for the company, regardless of her own feelings about the term? Well, I mean, here's the thing. When you say the word diva, unless you are a WWE fan and you have been trained and conditioned to know what they mean by that, the word diva has a negative connotation. The word diva, I think of the word diva, I think, wow, what a bitch. You hear that word thrown around about musicians and celebrities who, you know, they throw fits and they don't treat people the right way, or they're very conceited and stuck up, or they have these bizarre requests about, you know, you hear this sometimes where someone's staying at a hotel and they send a request to the hotel in advance. I want only blue M&Ms. I don't want any red M&Ms or yellow M&Ms. When I get to my room, I want blue M&Ms, and I want a mint under my pillow, and I want extra A batteries stocked in the room for the vibrator, and give me a fucking break. That's what I think of when I hear the term diva. I think when most people hear the term diva, and so yes, there is a negative connotation to it. It's just a stupid word to use. By this point, it's become the branding, and they have total divas. They're not going to change the name of the show, so the word diva's not going anywhere. It doesn't matter at this point. I agree with her that the belt looks like shit. I mean, it really does. I mean, come on. I mean, it looks like a giant vagina, and they should just change the belt. Whether they go back to the old belt, create a new one. You don't have to go back to the old one. Just make a new one. Make it the women's championship. You could still have a divas division, but call it the women's title. But the belt itself, I agree with her 100%. The belt looks ridiculous. I don't know why anybody would even want to hold it. It's not worth fighting for. As far as Trish and Lita and why there was not all this outrage back then, I mean, I think the people who think the term is stupid have always felt that way. Honestly, I don't... Were they using the word diva back then? I mean, it depends how far back we're going here. I don't remember them using the word diva, like branding it the Divas division or the Divas title back then. I think you're wrong on that. I mean, Trish and Lita, I mean, that goes back to 2001, 2002. I'm almost positive they weren't using that word back then the way they are now. But I think when you fast forward a little bit, you talk about Michelle McCool and Candice Michelle, and you get into those, you know, women, when they did start referring to them as divas. I mean, look, maybe the outrage just wasn't there because in a lot of ways, you know, I mean, it kind of was. You still had a lot of that, like, quote-unquote, divas mentality in bra and panties matches and stuff like that, and it almost didn't matter. Now it's like, well, we're trying to get away from that. You know, we're not doing the bra and panties matches anymore. We're not doing, you know, the women are not out there half naked. And we have women who are far more talented in the ring, and we're getting longer matches. And it's like a more serious thing now than it was 5 or 8 years ago. And so I think part of it is, well, how then do you take it seriously when you have a butterfly belt and you call them divas? And I think that's why more people take objection to it now than they did, you know, 8 years ago. Trish and Lita, this wasn't even an issue because there wasn't even such a thing as the Divas division back then. It was still the women's title. But I think that's why you have more people who are kind of upset with that word or who think it should be abandoned. This comes from Ted. I came home for lunch on Friday and the February 5th, 1996 episode of Raw was on the network. I was watching it when Jerry Lawler had a line that made me scratch my head. It was during the Undertaker versus Bret Hart match for the championship, and Lawler was talking about how many changes Roddy Piper had made to the WWF since he took over after Gorilla Monsoon's injury. He said, "Piper's changing cards all over the place. He's come up with some kind of match called a triple threat match. What's that?" This surely could not have been the first time the triple threat match was introduced to the company, could it? To your knowledge, were there any higher-profile triple threat matches, or any at all, actually, before this point in WWF history? No, believe it or not, that would have been the first time they ever did a triple threat match in WWE, and it never actually happened. I remember seeing local ads around here around that time. Piper was president. They credited him with the idea. It was for, I think it was a show at the Meadowlands. I didn't go to it. I did look up the results. It was the Meadowlands, actually. And it, in every instance that year, in 1996, where they had hyped up a triple threat match for the local show, it never happened. The one at the Meadowlands, it was supposed to be Undertaker, Diesel, and Bret, but they said Diesel was hurt, so it was just a singles match. I checked to see when the first one would have actually taken place, and the earliest one I could find a record of was a house show in January of 1997. In Dallas, and this, see, it depends how technical you want to get here. It's listed as an elimination match. Shawn Michaels, Bret Hart, and Psycho Sid. It's not triple threat rules, even though it's still a three-way match. So you could say that technically was the first one. They did it again in Oklahoma City the next night, but on that same card, they had what's listed as a triple threat match with Ahmed Johnson, Farouk, and Mankind. So by actual triple threat rules, that would have been the first one in WWE. Now, on TV, they didn't do one until June of that year. And if you want the first really big triple threat they ever did on pay-per-view, you mentioned high-profile matches. I don't think, and somebody will correct me if I'm wrong, but I don't think they did one until Breakdown, which was a pay-per-view they did in September of 1998. Again, I know they had some on Raw before then, with like Owen Hart and Goldust, I think, and stuff like that, but that's not high profile. We're talking high profile. I think Breakdown would have been the first time, and they did two big three-way matches on that show. They did Rock, Mankind, and Ken Shamrock in a cage, which was a great match, by the way, and they did Austin, Undertaker, and Kane. That was the match where Austin lost the title. So there you go. That shed some light there on the triple threat history in WWE. It surprised me, too, that it took them that long to kind of come up with this concept or steal it or whatever they did. But yeah, they didn't have one officially until 1997. Major from Richmond, Virginia. Buy or sell on which you would rather be on the receiving end of: Brock Lesnar's Suplex City or Big Van Vader's forearm strikes? Oh, I'm going Suplex City, baby. I'm buying on Suplex City. I forgot which wrestler it was. They were being interviewed recently. God damn it, I forgot which. I don't remember who it was. But they were talking about Lesnar's suplexes and how it would actually be fun to take them. And my eyebrows kind of went up when they said that. But, you know, they were talking about it like, if you know how to take them, it could be fun. It won't hurt. And there is something to be said for that. Yeah, I guess I could see that if you're taking them the right way, as long as you don't get, you know, every now and then he'll stick one in there where you get folded up like an accordion and you land on the back of your neck. I would imagine that's not too much fun. But Vader in his prime, I mean, those forearm strikes, those punches with those heavy gloves, oh, no, 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 no way. Yeah, they would tell the stories back in the day in WCW, like if there was a Saturday night taping, you know, they were taping TV at Universal or Disney, wherever it was, and they'd have like a board in the back, I guess like a blackboard, and you could go up to it and see who you were wrestling that night. And they would tell, and there are stories that guys have told that, you know, you'd be like a job guy, and the job guy would go over and would see that he had Vader that night, and he would just leave. He wouldn't even stick around. I totally believe it. I don't think those are just stories they're telling to kind of boost the, you know, the legend of Vader. I can totally see that. And you know what? If they were paying me, you know, whatever. If they're paying me $50 or $100, and I got to get in there with a guy like Vader who has a reputation for beating the crap out of people, I'd probably leave too. Or when no one's looking, I'd take the eraser. I'd erase my name and I'd write somebody else's name in there. Yeah, no, you couldn't pay me to take those forearm strikes. So I'm buying on Suplex City and I'm selling on Vader. Gian from, was it Gian or Gian? Say Gian from West Palm Beach, Florida. Buy or sell? As both a booker / promoter and as an on-air performer, Paul Heyman or Jim Cornette? See, and I was gonna leave this one because this is a tough one, kind of, but I decided to put it in here. I was thinking about it, and I said, I think I can answer it now. First of all, Heyman, Cornette, two of the best of all time. As far as talkers, right? Two of the best of all time. Cornette had a good thing going for a while with Smoky Mountain. He ran his own promotion for a few years there. ECW obviously left a much bigger impact than Smoky Mountain did. So, you know, if we're comparing them as promoters, I'd have to give the edge to Heyman. Cornette worked for TNA. He worked for everybody, really. He worked for the NWA. He worked for WWE. He worked for TNA. He worked for ROH. And with TNA and ROH... and WWE, I guess, too, in terms of Ohio Valley, didn't end well. Didn't end well. In fact, I can't think of a place in the last 15 years or 20 years that Jim Cornette was where things ended you know, fairly amicably. It seems like there was always some kind of problem, or he was fired, or people were complaining or something. Heyman, when Heyman was writing SmackDown, which was probably... 2003, maybe 2003, SmackDown was the A show. And not like arguably the A show. There is no argument. SmackDown was the A show between Raw and SmackDown. Far, far better than Raw. Now, that didn't last long either, although that didn't have anything to do with the quality of the show. I don't think anybody was complaining about the quality of SmackDown. There were other, you know, political things going on or whatever, and Heyman got ousted. You know, and I still wonder if Dixie Carter would have been willing to give Paul what he wanted when he was being considered to take over things in TNA. You know, how different things might be for them right now. I think Cornette is a smart guy. I think he would absolutely be a valuable resource to anybody who was running a wrestling company, no matter how dated some of his... you know, perspectives might be, some of the things he said. I'm not, you know, excusing any of that stuff, but he's got a mind for the wrestling business. There's no doubt about it. You know, he's up there with guys like Heyman and Dutch Mantel, and these are smart guys who know about pro wrestling. But Heyman seems more open-minded to more modern ideas. He did a great interview many years ago with Ariel Helwani. Find it. I'm sure it's on YouTube. This was before he came back to WWE. And he talks about some of this stuff. And this might have been around the time that, you know, he was talking about meeting with Dixie and TNA and all that. I mean, the guy gets it. You know, he gets it. He can adapt. He can change with the times. He's not stuck, you know, well, back when I did things in ECW, this is how I would do it today. Like, no, you know, the world has changed since then. The world has changed. Wrestling has definitely changed. And ECW was 20 years ago. And if you don't adapt, you die. And I think he gets that. As an on-air performer, look, you know, Cornette, again, one of the best promos, but so is Heyman. And the work that Paul Heyman has done just in the last, you know, 3 years or whatever it's been that Brock has been back, probably his best stuff. That's saying a lot. That's saying a lot. I mean, the guy is, he's incredible. The pairing with Brock, and even the Dangerous Alliance stuff back in the day, I got to give the edge to Heyman. I got to give the edge to Heyman. So I'm buying on Paul Heyman, and I'm selling on Jim Cornette. Speaking of the Dangerous Alliance, we have one final buy or sell. This one from Big Zeus in D.C. Buy or sell, the Heenan family from 1987 to 1991, or I'm sorry, 1987 to 1989, or the Dangerous Alliance from 1991 to 1993. Now, let me just say, I grew up a WWF fan, not a WCW fan. Although I would watch it, you know, against my will, whenever I went to my grandparents' house on the weekends. They had cable, we didn't, so we'd go over there on a Saturday night. They had TBS on, and I would sit there, and I would see Sting and Vader and Arn Anderson and all these guys, and I was like, ugh, is WWF on? I can appreciate it now, but back then I didn't appreciate what I had. So I grew up on the Heenan family, feuding with Hulk Hogan and the Ultimate Warrior. Now, if you were a young WCW fan in the early 90s, you grew up on the Dangerous Alliance, and they were feuding with Sting, right? That's just how it was. Kind of goes back to the question of Heenan or Heyman. You know, I say Heenan, because I'm a Heenan guy. But it's tough. Now, the common thread, you know, when I was thinking about this, it really struck me how many similarities there were. The common thread between the two groups is that they didn't start in WWF or WCW. They started in the AWA. There were a lot of different incarnations of the Heenan family. Nick Bockwinkel, Ken Patera. And Patera did carry over with the Heenan stuff into WWF. But those guys and a lot of others were part of the group long before guys like Big John Studd and Andre the Giant were. I don't remember who the original Dangerous Alliance members were, but when you look at the talent that that group had in WCW... It was short. It was a pretty short period of time. Really, it was only 1992 that the group existed, but they were dominant. You know, they had Rick Rude, Arn Anderson, both of whom were also Heenan family members, ironically. Stunning Steve Austin, Larry Zbysko, Bobby Eaton, Medusa. I mean, that's a hell of a group. There's some real talent in that group. And they held the U.S. title. They had the tag team titles during that period. They might have had the TV title too. I don't remember. I think Austin did. You look at the Heenan family during that 87 to 89 period, which is what we're talking about here. We're not talking about any other years. We're talking about those years. Rick Rude had the Intercontinental title. Arn and Tully had the tag team titles, and then Andre and Haku, after them, had the tag team titles. And look at the guys that Heenan had. He went to the main event of WrestleMania 3 with Andre the Giant against Hulk Hogan. He had Harley Race, you know, one of the greatest NWA champions of all time. Mr. Perfect. Rick Rude. The Brainbusters. I think the problem, though, is they gave... I mean, Heenan must have managed like 50 guys in his career. He was so good at what he did, it's like, well, let's just give them to Bobby, and Bobby will be able to talk for them. He'll be able to help them out. The problem is that they also gave him guys like the Red Rooster during that period. The Brooklyn Brawler was a Heenan guy. You know, the Heenan family, it was like, it became like the NWO. it was a great example of what can happen when you add too many members. Gets watered down. It's like when the NWO added Vincent and guys like that. That's kind of what it was like. So if we're talking just 87 to 89 and 91 to 93, honestly, I'm going to buy on the Dangerous Alliance and I'm going to sell on the Heenan family. I think Heyman's group was more dominant in a shorter period of time. Those three guys alone, Rick Rude, Arn Anderson, and Steve Austin, I mean, that's hard to beat. I know Heenan had Andre, but he was already washed up by that point. That was not the Andre of old. He could barely move. And, you know, I haven't gotten to it yet in our WCW countdown, but I can tell you right now it's one of the matches I have on my list. And in fact, you know what? We're going to do it next week. How about that? We'll do this next week. Probably the greatest War Games match in history involved the Dangerous Alliance. It was the Dangerous Alliance against Sting's Squadron. That match was incredible. You're not going to find any Heenan family matches that good. I can tell you that. So I think that's another reason to buy on the Dangerous Alliance. Sad tweet this week goes to Michelle Beadle of ESPN. At Michelle D. Beadle is her handle. She was a big-time WWE fan, and then Triple H tweeted his support for Floyd Mayweather before Mayweather's last fight. And she took great offense to this because I guess, you know, she's appalled by Mayweather's treatment of women and how could Triple H support somebody who's, you know, domestically abused his girlfriends or wives or whatever. And so she said, I'm not going to watch WWE anymore. And this was many months ago. And as the story goes, it was Vince McMahon who recently reached out to her and facilitated a meeting. Raw was in California this week, and so she came to the Raw show, and she met with Triple H and Stephanie. I don't know if she met with Vince. And they patched things up, and all is well again. And Michelle Beadle is back in the WWE camp. And so what happened was Mark Madden, yes, that Mark Madden, who's still around, he sent a series of direct messages on Twitter to Michelle Beadle. And he's basically taking her to task for being a hypocrite. And he's saying, I don't understand. You know, Triple H is tight with Mayweather, always puts him over, and you're against that. And now you're posing for pictures with Triple H and Stephanie like your best friends. I'm just saying. You know, I mean, he was being respectful of it, but he took issue with it. Well, the reason this is all so sad is because Michelle Beadle posted a tweet. And this is what it said. She said, I used to block people like this. Now I realize it's not about me. Some folks just like to be, quote, that guy. And that would be fine. This is in reference to Madden. But she went and she posted screenshots of the DMs that they exchanged. I'm going to assume she did not ask him for permission to post those DMs. She just went and posted them. And she did so as a way to insult the guy. Look, I'm not a Mark Madden fan. I have no use for the fucking guy. I never liked him. But that's not cool. That's not cool. Because unless, you know, the guy gives permission, or unless they're threatening in some way, and these were not threatening messages in any way, it's not cool to take a private conversation like that and post screenshots for everybody to see. That's pretty fucking sad. And so that's why Michelle Beadle gets sad tweet for this week. If you have suggestions for sad tweet, we don't do it every week, but if there's a good one, and you notice it, tweet me, at Solomonster, and let me know, and I might be able to use it here on the podcast.
When it's all said and done in this world, this will go down as one of the greatest title matches in pay-per-view history.
We are counting down the best 15 matches in WCW history, one match per week for 15 weeks leading up to the anniversary of the final Nitro next month. Last week was number 9. We did Ric Flair and Vader for the WCW World title at Starrcade 1993. Match number 10 of 15. You heard Tony Schiavone there call it one of the greatest pay-per-view title matches in history. Some would say maybe the greatest match of either man's career, from Halloween Havoc, October 26, 1997, from the MGM Grand Garden Arena in Las Vegas, Eddie Guerrero and Rey Mysterio Jr., for the WCW Cruiserweight Championship title versus mask match. The match still holds up after all these years. I could tell you going back and watching it, it still holds up. But one thing did surprise me about it. And maybe it's just that it's been so long since I've seen it, but the match was slower than I remember it being. It had more slow spots than I remember. Eddie really slowed it down a few times with the submissions. I remember it being just nonstop action. And I wouldn't call it that. I wouldn't call it nonstop action. There definitely were stops in the action. And that doesn't make it a bad match by any means. I mean, the match had it all. It had flashy moves that, you know, people had never seen before. Great psychology. Two of the best in the game at that time. Two of the best of all time, really. This was Ray in his prime. And Eddie had really come into his own as a heel. 1997 was the year that Eddie Guerrero really became a player in WCW. And it's funny, you know, one of the matches I rewatched a couple of months ago, and I wanted to include it in this countdown, but it didn't make the cut. I couldn't fit it in. Was a match on Nitro in May of 1996 between Eddie Guerrero and Ric Flair. It's a very good match, long match too, like 20 minutes. But you look at Eddie in that match and look at him here a year and a half later, and it's like two totally different people. Just like physically, the transformation was night and day. Whatever he was doing at the time, he looked fantastic. He looked to be in the best shape of his life. We had four announcers for this match. Tony Schiavone on play-by-play with Dusty Rhodes, Bobby Heenan, and Mike Tenay. Mike Tenay, they would trot him out there routinely for all the luchador matches because he knew the names to all the moves. He knew the history. And I'm a Bobby Heenan fan till the day I die, but I got to say, he really had no business calling matches like this. You know, him or Dusty. I mean, pick one or the other. Having them both on headset for this match was completely unnecessary. Although, I have to say, we did get one great moment where Dusty talked about their athletic schism. That's what he called it. These guys, man, this match here, daddy, there's a lot of athletic schism going on, daddy. And Schiavone even mocked him for it. What? Athletic schism? Oh, that's a word. So even Tony mocked him for it. Ray was wearing, it's like a purple onesie with question marks all over it. So Eddie would try to rip the mask off, but it was part of the costume, so it's not like you just pull the mask off. He kept ripping at it. Eventually, he ripped like a hole in the eye socket. You could see Ray's eye was exposed. There was one spot in this match that was just incredible even now. I'm watching this match almost 20 years later, and it's every bit as cool now as it was then. This was actually the part where Dusty talked about their athleticism. Eddie's out on the floor. Ray hits the ropes. He does a flip dive over the top rope, lands on Eddie outside the ring, and in one fluid motion, turns it into a Hurricanrana. That was fucking cool. So back inside, we get a split-legged moonsault from Ray. Eddie got his knees up. Eddie just destroys him with a powerbomb. I mean, I could see the concussion. That's how brutal this was. Eddie goes up for the frog splash. Ray rolls out of the way. They both end up on the top rope. Eddie goes for a razor's edge. And actually, I don't even know if he was going for a razor's edge. He had him up in like the razor's edge position. He was probably going for that crucifix powerbomb move. I forgot the name that they use for it. But on the way down, Ray counters that into a Frankensteiner and gets the pin and wins the championship. WCW didn't have to do much with the cruiserweights other than just give these guys a platform to go out there and do their thing. And they were so far ahead of what WWE was doing at the time with their light heavyweight division. Their light heavyweight division was just their answer to the, you know, what WCW was doing with their cruiserweights at the time. And they tried. I mean, look, at least, hey, Vince, I said earlier in the podcast that the difference between Vince and Triple H here in 2016 is that one guy is willing to change and the other one isn't. At least back then, Vince seemed to be more open to trying new things. It's funny how that works when your company is losing and in second place and getting their ass kicked every week, how more open you are to new ideas. But he tried. They had their light heavyweight division. Nothing they ever did with it, though, can measure up to what we saw with the cruiserweights in WCW. And as Ray's celebrating, so he wins the championship, he's in the corner, he's talking into the camera, and Eddie just nails him from behind, throws him out of the ring, and Ray just gets up and leaves. It was very awkward, and there's a reason for that. It may have been something of a compromise, because there is a backstory here. Only about an hour before the match, up until about an hour, maybe even less, Eddie Guerrero was supposed to win this match. There was a lot of drama going on backstage because Rey did not want to lose that mask. That mask meant a lot to him. I'm sure, you know, just historically, sentimentally, but also business-wise, he had his reasons for not wanting to lose that mask. And really, it was fucking stupid for WCW to even consider taking the mask off this guy at the time. But they wanted him to, and Rey didn't want to. And for all the credit that Eric Bischoff deserves in bringing these guys into the company, he had no respect for the tradition of the mask. We saw that time and time again. And eventually, Rey did get forced to unmask, but it was many years later. He didn't want to do it then either. It was a whole big political thing, and Conan was involved. But here, Rey didn't want to lose the mask, and Bischoff told him a few days before the pay-per-view, look, if you don't lose it, you're going to be in breach of contract, and I'm going to fire you, and I might even sue you. But at the show, right before the match, Bischoff changed his mind. And Rey's done interviews where he's talked about that night and how Eddie Guerrero came up to him and said, look, we don't have to do the match if you don't want to. We don't have to go through with this. We can put our foot down. He was, you know, backing Rey up 110%. This wasn't about, like, him not wanting to do a job. That had nothing to do with this. But Rey said, no, we got to do this. Let's do this. And then they got word that he didn't have to lose the mask and he was going to win the championship. So I wonder if, you know, him, you know, hitting Rey from behind and throwing him out like a jabron and Rey just walking off, and Eddie was really the one who was left standing tall in the ring when all was said and done. I wonder if maybe that was something of a little, you know, compromise to keep Eddie looking strong. But it was nice to see a Rey Mysterio-Eddie Guerrero match that didn't involve custody of Rey's kid hanging above the ring in a briefcase. That was nice. I try to forget that ever happened. Which is too bad, because as ladder matches go, that was a pretty good one, actually, at SummerSlam that year. It was also pretty funny watching Eddie snap and just lose his cool when Vicky missed her cue, and he's pounding on the mat, he's cursing up a storm, where the fuck is Vicky? I'm sure they must have edited that off the network. I should go back and check. Follow me on Twitter, at Solomonster. Don't forget to vote in our Raw poll every Monday night as soon as the show goes off the air. And you can even follow along tonight during the Fastlane pay-per-view. I'll be live tweeting during the show. I'll have a thread up on our Facebook group as usual. Leave us some love in iTunes and Stitcher. We are a 5-star rated podcast on iTunes, so thank you very much. You can write a review. You can rate us on a star scale. It helps the show out immensely when you do so. So on iTunes or Stitcher, please take a moment and do that. We are going to be back next weekend for episode 427. Enjoy the Fastlane pay-per-view tonight. It is the last one before WrestleMania. I'm sure we'll have a lot to talk about next week. So until then, be well, stay safe. Have yourselves a great week. I am headed for jury duty on Monday, which is so much fun. Fingers crossed I don't get picked for a trial. My luck, it'd end up like the OJ trial. I would be sequestered and there would be no sound off for 6 months. Let's hope that doesn't happen. I don't expect it to, but I'll give everybody the update next week. So have yourselves a great week. We'll see you back here next Sunday. Take care, guys.
The good, the bad, and the ugly. The Solomonster sounds off.
You know what annoyed me more than anything else on this show last Monday night? Instead of just calling it Fastlane, they called it WWE Fastlane.
At WWE Fastlane, I'm going to beat you.
Drove me nuts.
You and I are going to have a match at WWE Fastlane.
All night with this. Who talks like that? If aliens landed on Earth and attempted to engage a member of the WWE roster in a conversation, you know what they would think? Holy shit, these creatures are stupid. And then they would exterminate every last one of us.
The Monster Sounds Off.
Since 2007, The Solomonster Sounds Off. Available at thesolomonster.com, Stitcher Radio, TuneIn Radio, iTunes, and more.
Solo Monsters Sound Off.